Good evening, everyone. Just we have a couple more people on Zoom, and so I wanted to start closer to the 8 o'clock mark. If people come in, I'll try to give a brief summary as we progress. But thank you all for joining both in person as well as on Zoom to this special edition, if you will, of our series From People to Nation, which studies the evolution of Judaism and the Jewish people during the times of the Avos and Imahos, during the times of the patriarchs and the matriarchs, until Matan Torah, until the giving of the Torah, which is when, as we said in the first shiur, Rav Soloveitchik and Kol Dodi Dofeik said that we became a nation. We transitioned from an amalgamation of people to a nation. This week, I want to do something a little bit different. It's still very much thematically connected and part of what I want to talk with you about, but because of the significance of this evening and tomorrow of Kristallnacht, I believe it's the 84th anniversary, if you will, of the pogrom, of the tragedy. I wanted to learn something with you in memory of those that were killed, as well as the terrible Chilul Hashem of that initial event that happened, as well as what it ultimately led to over the next few years. To do that, I want to share with you a tshuva, a responsa that was written by one of the great pre-war German rabbis. He lived in the 1800s. Many people don't know him or don't know that he was a German rabbi, but he was actually Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Rebbe, or one of his Rebbeim. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch had two primary Rebbeim, two primary teachers, and the person that we're going to be learning about today is one of them. His name is Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Some of you may know him from his commentary on the Talmud, the Aruch Laner. Some of you may know him by his Sefer on Sukkah, the Bikurei Yaakov. And some of you might know him from his Tshuvas, which is what we're going to be learning, the Binyan Sion. And so Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was one of the Rebbeim of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. He was the first German Orthodox rabbi and Talmud Chacham to go to university. As a young man, he studied in the University of Würzburg. And in the middle of his studies for his doctorate, there was a riot, there were anti-Semitic riots, and he was forced out of town. And he was forced to abandon his study because of that. But he was the first German Orthodox Talmud Chacham to go to university. Reports say that even when he was fully immersed in his study, he was always completely thinking about Torah. But he was the first German Rav to go to university to preach in German, in the common vernacular. He started multiple schools for both boys and girls that integrated Limudei Kodesh, Judaic studies, and secular studies. He wanted to create a rabbinic seminary that not only would teach halacha and Torah, but would also teach homiletics, essentially the more professional elements of the rabbinate. He also had a dream to build a rabbinic seminary in Yerushalayim. There's a bit of a debate among scholars as to whether he wanted to incorporate secular studies there or not. And two of his greatest students were Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and Rav Hildesheimer, who became, they had different roles in the German communities, but they became very much leaders of German Orthodoxy, and a lot of the ideas and policies that they instituted and lived by were inspired by Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. So we're going to come to him soon. We're going to start off, though, in a slightly different location, namely Yerushalayim. Yes.
We're talking about 1848.
So we'll get to the exact date in a moment. The year is 1848. This year will be important. So just remember that. But I just want to set the scene for you. So we're in Yerushalayim, the old city. It's the 23rd of Adar Sheni, in the year 1848. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is nowhere involved. He doesn't know what's going on right now. He'll know in a few months. But the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazi community at that time was Rav Shmuel Salant. He was away. And so the assistant rabbi was in charge and running the show. His name was Rav Asher Lemel. Rav Asher Lemel was a Rav before he came to Yerushalayim to be the assistant rabbi. He was the Rav of Galan in Central Europe, and he was a close friend of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. And that's how the story eventually went to him. So Rav Asher Lemel was the assistant rabbi at the time, and he was kind of running the show while Rav Shmuel Salant was away. And we have a number of sources, different versions of the account of what happens. This is one version. They're all pretty much the same. It's just however many flowery details one version has over the other. I'm not going to go through everything here, but this is essentially a letter that Rav Asher Lemel wrote trying to justify his actions of what will transpire. So I'm going to share the screen right now so that everybody on Zoom can also see this. Let me go back to the beginning here. Hold on. There we go. Okay. So Rav Asher Lemel is writing a letter to the great rabbis, and most pointedly to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. And he says, Yilmedenu Rabbeinu, teach us our master. Something happened. It's sort of Murphy's Law that when something can go wrong, it will go wrong. So when Rav Shmuel Salant was away, just the unexpected happened. The story is in Yerushalayim, 23rd of Adar Sheni, 1848. Again, remember that date. A Gentile had come from Morocco. He says, Echad Sheba, Hine mi Medinas, Morocco, Lishem Geirus, Bifanenu, based in Sedek, the Kehal Ashkenazim. So a guy, ostensibly, from Morocco, came to the Ashkenazi based in Yerushalayim and wanted to convert to Judaism. And so we looked into it. They found him to be a very genuine person, very committed. And they said, okay, we'll accept your conversion. So he accepted Torah and mitzvos. And as we know, there are a few things that you need to do to convert. So the first is you need to accept Torah and mitzvos. And not only do you need to accept Torah mitzvot, you also need to accept to be part of the fate of the Jewish people. If you just want to keep the mitzvot but not identify as a Jew, that won't work. The conversion won't work. You need to essentially sign up for anything that will happen in Jewish history, whether it be the good things or whether it be Kristallnacht. And so he did that. The second thing that you need to do if you're a male is to get circumcised, which is what he did. The third thing that you need to do is go to a mikvah. So he had been circumcised. Now, back then, mikvahs were not chlorinated, and medical procedures were not as advanced as they were now, and medicine was not as great. And so you didn't go to the mikvah right after you were circumcised. You needed to wait. You needed to let the wounds heal. You needed to recuperate, especially if you're an adult, especially if you're on the older side. You need to recover from the procedure. So oftentimes, this was not unusual, there was a bit of a gap in the conversion process between the circumcision and the immersion in the mikvah. So that's what this person was doing. He got circumcised, I don't know, on a Tuesday, let's say, and he's recovering. And in between the circumcision and the immersion in the mikvah was Shabbos. So he was sort of convalescing at home on Shabbos. And so people decided to visit him. People wanted to do Bikur Cholim for this person. And they found that he wasn't doing too well. He was very weak. They didn't think that it was Pikuach Nefesh. They didn't think that it was life and death, that you could violate Shabbos, but he wasn't well. And the halacha is that if somebody is not at risk of life and limb, or life, but they are at risk either of losing a limb, or they've fallen down in bed, or they're essentially incapacitated, you're allowed to tell a non-Jew to do malacha, to do work for you, to violate the Shabbos, to help him get better. And so that's what his friends wanted to do. They said, look, you're not doing well. Let's have a non-Jew. Let's have an Arab come in. He'll light a fire. He'll heat up some water. He'll give you some medicine. Like, he'll do stuff to help you. And this convert was such a frum person that he didn't want to. Higiduli. They came to this Rav Asher Lemel in the second box. He says, they came to me. Lomar, saying, Mizrizaso b'mitzvos, for his great zeal for mitzvos. Echu nizhar b'shvisas Shabbos, how careful he was with keeping Shabbos. Hagam shu odenu b'chlal cholesh ein bo sakana, even though he was an ill person that wasn't at risk of losing their life. Eino miniach l'goy l'havir esh. He did not allow them to call a non-Jew to light a fire, to heat up some water, to help him get better. And so they were concerned about him. So these people went to Rav Asher Lemel and said, look, can you're the rabbi now. You're the acting rabbi. Can you tell him? Can you tell him that it's okay and that he needs to do this? And Rav Asher Lemel said, I don't understand. He's not Jewish yet. He didn't go to the mikveh. So you don't need a guy to violate Shabbos. He needs to violate Shabbos. As we'll see in a moment, and this is how we connect to the Avos, and this will be our question, a non-Jewish person is not allowed to keep Shabbos. It's not that they don't have to keep Shabbos. As we'll see, they're not allowed to keep Shabbos. So the Gemara said that all of the Avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, it also says that Yosef kept Shabbos. How could they keep Shabbos if, as we said in previous weeks, they weren't Jewish? And so Rav Asher Lemel thought, so, okay, maybe he doesn't have the strength to light a fire, but he needs to violate Shabbos. He's not Jewish yet. And so he said, go back to him and tell him that he needs to violate Shabbos. So the sun is setting. You know, they're under a time crunch. So they go back to this guy's house, and this prospective convert is just so, you know, he's had this tremendous ordeal. He's weak. He's recovering. And now he has to violate Shabbos. So there's another account where it says that he was literally crying, that he had to do this. But look, the Rav, the assistant rabbi, tells you to do something, you do it. And so it says that he wrote his name on a piece of paper. And in the other account, it said there were tears coming down his cheeks as he did it, but that's what he had to do. And ultimately he recovered. And later on, he went to the mikveh, as we'll see. So Rav Asher Lemel went to bed that night thinking, okay, everything's good. I made sure that this guy kept halacha. I made him violate Shabbos. Everything's good and okay. When he woke up in the morning, everything was not okay. The entire community was up in arms. If you look in the third box, Vayehi Bayom HaMacharas, and it was on the next day. And again, this is just him kind of bemoaning what happened. Kasher Nishma Hadavar Be'ir HaKodesh. When news got out in the holy city, Po Tzavchu Alai Chachmei Sfarad V'Chachmei Ashkenazim, the Sfardi Rabbanim got mad at me, the Ashkenazi Rabbanim got mad at me, Al Dvar Chadosh Halazu Asher Lo Nishma Me'olam. They said, you invented something new in Judaism. You created this newfangled halachic ruling that this guy is not Jewish. And they said, we've had converts before, we've never done this. And this is a very interesting phenomenon where Jewish practice seems to go against what the text says. As we'll see, Rav Asher Lemel has a Gemara to back him up. But all of the Rabbanim, all of the lay people, they all were up in arms that this upstart, this assistant rabbi, we give him a couple days to function, and he creates this new halacha that this person's not Jewish because they didn't go to mikveh yet. He was circumcised. And they said that we have no idea where this Rav Asher Lemel is coming from. Now, Rav Asher Lemel is trying to justify his actions. And so he said, Va'amina, and I responded, Taima Didi, he'amnam meharoi hoyali his yayetz bazem chachme revarabana ir hakodesh, terem nase hamaisa. He says, you know, look, I recognize I'm only the assistant rabbi. I should have, you know, consulted with all of you people. But he says, look, it was getting late. Shabbos was almost over. He needed to violate Shabbos. And also, he says, the matter seemed so obvious to me that I didn't think I needed to. Rav Herschel Schechter from YU, he often says that there's a difference between being a posek and answering a halachic question. You know, sometimes you're just a computer. There's a source in a text and you say the source. That's not called paskening. That's not called deciding the halacha. You're just quoting a source. You don't need to be a posek to tell somebody what a sefer says. To be a posek means to formulate an original idea from the text. And so Rav Asher Lemel says, I didn't think this was such a big deal. As you see, when you turn the page, there's a Gemara that seems to explicitly support what he's saying. So in source number two is a pasuk from Parshas Noach, which we read a few weeks ago. And this is the source that the Gemara uses. It says, Yom v'layla lo yishbosu. God said that people had too much free time in the antediluvian world. People before the Mabel had too much free time on their hands. Life was too perfect. And as the phrase goes, idle hands are the devil's plaything or something like that. When you have too much free time, people sin. And so Hashem said, I'm going to make life difficult now. There's going to be winter. There's going to be summer. And day and night won't rest. The Gemara interprets that saying not that day and night won't cease, but people won't cease from working day and night. The Gemara in source number 3 says, V'amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says, Ovid kochavim sheshavas chayiv misa. A non-Jew that keeps Shabbos in its totality deserves the death penalty. Now, the Rambam says that we don't actually give them the death penalty. It means that heaven says, look, you deserve to die for this offense. Shene'emar, why is this a problem? V'yom v'layla lo yishbosu. So it says that day and night you shall not rest. The entire humanity is not allowed to take vacation. The Jewish people have a special dispensation from God for one day that they can take a vacation, and they're supposed to take a vacation. But the rest of the world is not allowed to. And if you look in source number 4, it's very clear from that Rav Asher Lemel says, look, this guy doesn't fit the bill of being a Jew yet. The Omer Rab Chia Bar Abba, Omer Rab Yochanan, La'olam Ein Ger Ad Sheyimol V'Yitbol. A person is not a convert until they have a bris and until they go to mikvah. The Kevan De Lo Tavil Oved Kochavim. And until this person has both, they're still a non-Jewish person. And so Rav Asher Lemel says, look, this is so clear right now. I didn't think I needed to consult with anybody. And yet, the Ashkenazi and the Sfardi Rabbanim in Yerushalayim were right, that historically, we have essentially ignored this Gemara. And the big question is, why or how? How does that work? And that was the question. Now, Rav Asher Lemel is in damage control mode, and so he tries to justify his actions, and he sends letters to all the Rabbanim to essentially say, please help me out right now. And one of them was sent to his friend, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger responds with a very interesting novel idea. As we'll see, it has a source, but it's a very interesting idea. And he responds almost over a year later, in source number 5, this is the 26th Chaf Vav Iyar, 2 days before Yom Yerushalayim, of 1849. He was the Rav in Altona at that point, which was in Denmark at that particular point in history. It eventually went back, reverted to Germany, I believe. But at that point, he, in order to essentially escape the anti-Semitism, he moved to Denmark at that point, and he was allowed to function as a Rav. I'm sorry, I'm not really sure why the screen popped up again. Okay, anyway. So Rav Asher Lemel, he responds to Rav Asher Lemel as the former chief dayan and galan, and presently in the holy city of Yerushalayim, right? So he doesn't call him the Rav, and he doesn't even call him the assistant rabbi. He just says, you are presently in the holy city, meaning that's the most important thing right now. Don't focus on the assistant rabbi part. Don't focus on your position. Just, I'm treating you as a yid in Yerushalayim. And we'll see that comes up again a little bit later. Just for the sake of time, I'm not going to go through everything, but he basically says, I've done some research. I've done some homework. And you're right. That's what the Gemara says. But if you look throughout history, and if you look in contemporary practice, there is no community that actually follows it. And so he says, I have no idea why. So I have to come up with an answer, meaning I have to justify Jewish practice. So he comes up with a very interesting idea. If you look, we're about 4 lines down the first box. He says, "Vinasata el libi." It came to my heart, "Limso tam lazet." Acharesha lechora, psak malek voda torasa. Meaning I had to come up with something since, you know, with your great scholarship, Musad al adne hadin ve'emes, your argument is clearly founded on truth and text. Avo, es atzmi ra'isi, But I've seen with my very own eyes, Shehadin im haminhag, dikvar mitzad hasvara, yemisnaget al haseichel. He says that, look, I have this rationale that it's almost a contradiction to say that they can't keep Shabbos. Acharei shemilas hager nikra bris. Right? So circumcision is called a bris, it's called a covenant. So somebody that's had circumcision has entered into a covenant with God. V'gam Shabbos nikra bris. And Shabbos is also called the covenant. So eich nemar achar shenichnas l'bris ha'achas yemuchrach l'hofer bris acheres. So it doesn't make sense to say that after you've entered into one covenant, you should be forced to violate another covenant. Now again, he doesn't really provide a source for that. He just says, it just makes sense to me that Shabbos is different than the rest of halacha. That they're not Jewish, they're not full-fledged Jewish yet, but they're not really not Jewish anymore. They've entered into a covenant with God. We mentioned in last week that there might be a middle category where you're not Jewish, but you're not not Jewish. And so Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, and for people that are interested, he has a very famous landmark response about how to treat non-Orthodox Jews. You know, do we consider them Jewish or not? Nobody had really had to contend with that question for millennia. So he lived at the very beginning of the Reform movement. And so he said, well, how do we relate to these people? And he formulated an entire policy, which people have continued to take seriously till this very day. And so you can see how his mind is working here along similar lines that, okay, they might not be fully fledged in the way we normally think about it, but they can't be nothing. They've entered into a covenant with God. So they don't have to keep all the mitzvot. But this person, how could he not keep Shabbos? It's impossible. And so he says, V'lochein, nira lani asdaiti, in the bold, it is in my humble opinion, da'av shadayin lo nechnas l'chal Yisrael gamur, even though he has not entered into the category of a full-fledged Jew, ad shetoval, until he's immersed, mikol makom misha shenichnas labris mila kvar nivdal michlal b'nei noah. That the moment that this person becomes circumcised, they have left the category of a Gentile. They're not a full-fledged Jew, but they're no longer a Gentile. And now he has a very interesting source. He has a very interesting proof from Tanakh. There's a story about a group of people that kept Shabbos, even though they didn't go to mikveh yet, but they had circumcision. I don't know if you saw the next box, but if you didn't, anybody think of any? Sorry?
I'm thinking of the group that it's finally just the
word
bearers for the basement.
Oh, the Givonim. This is right. So they're an interesting. It's a good idea that you brought up that the Givonim, the people that came to Moshe and Yehoshua, they're a very interesting category. The Gemara talks about it. I don't want to get into it because it is very nuanced, but that could be a possibility. So that's the Givonim. That's the Givonim. Yeah. I'm sorry. Right. Okay. So there is another category, a much bigger category, the entire Jewish people until they got to Matan Torah, right? So the Jewish people were circumcised in Egypt to eat the Karban Pesach, but they didn't go to mikveh until the time of Matan Torah in preparation for getting the Torah. And what happened in between? Hashem gave them the mitzvah of Shabbos at Marah. And so Rav Yaakov Ettlinger said, here, I have a case where people kept Shabbos, even though they didn't go to mikveh, but they had bris milah. So he said, look, that's what these Jewish people were. So we know the Torah says they at least kept one Shabbos. Moshe said that the seventh day, when you get the mun on Shabbos, there's not going to be any mun, don't go out. And so it says that the Jewish people kept Shabbos. That was one of the only time in history where the entire Jewish nation kept Shabbos. Right. So they right. So they went out. What does that mean? So did they actually violate Shabbos or not? That's a bit of a question. They violated what God told them of not to go out. But whether going out is an actual biblical violation or not, that's a bit of a question. But you're right. So they did go out. But they didn't get killed. The one that gathered sticks got killed out in the next week. But yeah, that's a good point. Anyway, so Rav Yaakov Ettlinger has this interesting theory that somebody that has been circumcised has entered into a covenant with God. They've ceased to be not Jewish, but they're not fully fledged Jewish. So that's his idea. And he has a proof from a Gemara. There's another proof from a Gemara, which is in source number 6. It's a Gemara in Yevamos. There's a special pasuk that says that somebody is not allowed to join the Karban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice. So Toshav V'Sachir Mai Avid Le, what do they do with the words of a sojourner and a renter? La'asuye ger shemol v'lo taval. It's coming to include this very case. Somebody that was circumcised but did not go to the mikveh yet, in the future, again, in what's it called? In the time of leaving Egypt, this pasuk was not said. This was said later. Meaning this is talking about in later history, somebody that fits this category is not allowed to partake in the Karban Pesach. So the Rashba, in source number 7, he asks, Imkein hainu akum. So why is this a chiddush? Why does the Gemara need to tell me this? It's obvious. I shouldn't need a pasuk to tell me this. He's not Jewish yet. And so he says, Shani hacha, this is different. Demiloso l'shem yahadus. Somebody that was circumcised for the purpose of joining the Jewish people, even though shelo nigmar geruso, even though his conversion has not finished, mikol makom kvar hischil v'nichnas ksas bedas yehudis. He has begun to enter the Jewish faith. And again, you see this gradation model where you don't have to be a full-fledged Jew to be part of the Jewish nation. There are some things that you can do and some things that you can't do. So you can't partake in the Karban Pesach, but maybe you should be able to keep Shabbos. So that is Rav Yaakov Ettlinger's answer. So that's one answer. There is another answer of Rav Shmuel Salant in the next source. I'm not going to go into it because it's rather creative. I'll just say it outside. He came back to this whole mess, and so he had to try to justify what his assistant did, and he couldn't. So he tried to essentially say, well, maybe you're really full-fledged Jewish when you're immersed, but when you have the opportunity to circumcise yourself and you don't, then retroactively you're not Jewish. So it's only when you're circumcised that the initial gerus happens retroactively, which was very creative. I don't think anybody actually agreed with it. He was kind of grasping at straws, which everybody was. But people really adopted Rav Yaakov Ettlinger's approach. There is one other answer which is given, which is probably the simplest answer. Again, whether it's universally accepted is a question. But the final answer, which will also help us understand what the avos were and what they bequeathed to us for all generations in good times and bad times, is from the Rambam. So the Rambam, in the halachos that talk about a non-Jew, he says this halacha, that they're not allowed to keep Shabbos. If you look in the second half of the first line, v'chein akum sheshavas afilu biyom mimos hachol, even if they have another Shabbos, not Saturday, if they rest on Sunday or Friday, im asa'uhu limtso kimo Shabbos chayiv misa. If they decided to essentially create a new Shabbos, they deserve the death penalty. Klalo shel davar. What's the general principle here? Ein manichen osan lechadesh das v'lasos mitzvos la'atman midaitan. A non-Jew, even if they're the most genuine person, is not allowed to invent their own religion. Jews aren't allowed to invent their own religion, and non-Jewish people are not allowed to invent their own religion. If you're a non-Jew, you can be a very good Gentile and keep Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. That's what the Rambam says. You can be a Ger Tzedek. You can be a Ger Tzedek. You can convert to Judaism, or you could be what's known as a Ger Toshav. You can be one of the righteous people of the nations of the world. Do kindness. Keep the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. Keep the 7 Noahide laws. And you can fulfill your destiny in life. The moment that you start to go against those commandments, society breaks down, and you have anarchy, you have inhumaneness that's done on just irrational philosophies of nationalism. What we saw 84 years ago, we saw society break down, and it was in the name of culture and nationalistic ideals. And you can kill people, you can break buildings, you can burn Sifrei Torah, you can torture people. The answer to that is that you need to keep the 7 Noahide laws. That's the only way you can do it. But you can't try to create your own ideology. You can't create your own religion, even if you're doing it for a good idea, even if you're doing it for the sake of heaven. Because the moment you do that, it's a slippery slope, and you can have completely just terrible societies. You can have barbaric societies. That's what happened to Sodom. And that's what happened in Nazi Germany. But what does the Rambam highlight? The klalo shel davar. The idea is that the prohibition is that they're not allowed to invent a religion. But what happens if the person is not inventing a religion? What happens if they're not doing it to invent a religion? What happens if they're doing it as part of Judaism? So this is a bit of a stretch, but this is what some people suggest, which is that if a person is keeping Shabbos in preparation to be Jewish, not because they want to create their own religion, but if they're doing it in preparation to be Jewish, then that's okay. And the proof is, if you go back to the first line of the Rambam also says there's another thing a non-Jew is not allowed to do, learn Torah. We got a problem here. How can a non-Jewish person learn about Judaism if they're not allowed to learn Torah? It says that if they learn Torah, they're chayav misa, so every convert should deserve the death penalty. That doesn't make any sense. So how is a non-Jew allowed to learn Torah to see if they want to become Jewish? The answer is that they're not allowed to create their own religion. But if you're learning Torah in preparation to become a Jew, that's not a problem. That's not cultural appropriation. That's not taking the unique heritage of the Jewish people for yourself. No, it's planning to join that. So, Rav Asher Weiss. Yes, there is a difference between study and practice, which is why, to my knowledge, contemporary conversion practice is that they get the prospective convert in the training stage. There's often a training stage where we tell you, experience Jewish life to see if you want to sign up for it. And so we tell the convert, keep Shabbos, but you have to violate one thing. So keep a whole Shabbos, but turn on a light, or write your name or something like that, or cook dinner. So there is a difference. But if we want to, again, try to justify Jewish practice, you could either say what Rav Yaakov Ettlinger says, that there's this middle category, or you could say no, that there's no problem of cultural appropriation of Judaism if you're doing it to convert. And so I asked this morning, I asked one of the Rabbanim in YU, his name is Rabbi Tzvi Ram. In addition to teaching in YU, he's also one of the head, I don't know exactly what his full title is, but he's one of the head people of the organization called GPS, Geirus Practices and Standards, which is the major Geirus organization that's affiliated with the Beis Din of America, that does most of the conversions for especially the YU community and beyond as well in the New York area and in America in general. And I asked him, what do people do? Because nowadays also there's a gap between Mila, between circumcision and immersion in the mikveh, even though now the mikveh is chlorinated, it's still a medical procedure that you need to recuperate from. And oftentimes there's a Shabbos in between. And he says that we still do what they did back then. We tell them to keep Shabbos. So again, we're just going against the Gemara. We're saying, I know Rav Asher Lemel, you're right, but we're going to ignore the Gemara, either because of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger's idea that they're in this middle category, or no, that you're practicing to be Jewish, and at this particular juncture, that's not called appropriating Judaism. There's a very nice formulation, right? So we've dealt with German Rabbanim. Now we'll go a little bit east to Eastern Europe. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik has this beautiful, brisker formulation of this idea of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. It's almost Hasidish, which is cute. If you look in the Chidushei Hagrach in source number 12, he says, Umikolze, in the second line, Umikolze Mucha, he takes this idea of the Rambam. He says the Rambam's whole idea is that you're not allowed to innovate religion. And so he says the Avos weren't innovating Judaism. Umikolze Muchach, Dibehachefza Hoyu Alehem Shem Yisrael. The Avos, the Imahos, the Shvatim, everybody before Matan Torah, they were the Jewish people, right? The formulation of Rav Soloveitchik in Kol Dodi Dofeik was that we transitioned from people to nation. So if you want to know what the Avos were, they were people. They were the Jewish people. They were Bnei Yisrael. They were the Jewish people. They were Bechefza Yisrael, but halachically, legally, they were not Jewish people. Ulefize nire, delo shayach kvar lomar dehaya aleim din akum sheshavas. So we can't say that they are in violation of the Talmudic law of a goy sheshavas, because they were not a goy sheshavas. They were not Gentiles anymore. Mikevan shebechefza hayu kvar Yisrael. Their essence was Jewish. And so I think it's a very beautiful idea that there are some mitzvos, there are some commandments in Judaism, they're not just standalone commandments that you have to be legally Jewish for. Some cut so deep to the essence of being a Jew, not just legally being a Jew, but the essence of being a Jew means you get to do these things and you need to do these things. So the Avos were in essence Jewish. And so they kept Shabbos. This convert was in essence Jewish. And so they kept Shabbos. And Rav Yaakov Ettlinger dealing with the reform. And if they keep Shabbos, okay, so if other things fall by the wayside, their essence is Jewish. Okay, so they're not keeping all of the standards of Judaism, but their essence is Jewish. And the flip side, on the negative side, the Nazis said, I don't care if you're a practicing Jew or you're not practicing Jew. If your essence is Jewish, we're going to target you. And so this idea was so important to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, to the Avos, to the people in Yerushalayim. And I think it's important for us too, that there are many commandments that we do, and there are many commandments that are important to do. And we don't rank them. But there's this idea of not only being legally Jewish, of fulfilling all the mitzvos, but it's being in essence Jewish, having one's essence of a Jew, of walking around saying, Ich bin a Yid, that I'm a Jew. And that means that a Jew takes Shabbos seriously. And so, before we get to the conclusion of this year, there's a very interesting epilogue. But we're dedicating this year in memory of those that were killed in Kristallnacht. We're dedicating it in memory of the terrible Chil Hashem that happened, of Jewish businesses, Jewish homes, Jewish shuls that were destroyed, Sifrei Torah that were burned, Sifrei Torah that were desecrated, Sidurim, Talesim, Tfilin. And the German police stood by. They did nothing. They condoned. They arrested. And they didn't care if you were legally Jewish or not. They didn't care if you were halachically Jewish. They cared if your essence was Jewish, they targeted you. And so one of the things that we can do to memorialize that, to never forget that, is to take stock on what it means to be Bechefza Yisrael, to be in essence a Jew, whether it means Shabbos, whether it means Bris Milah, whether it means other things. Think about what it means to be a Jew as an essence. And there's something very telling about it being called Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. So glass is not the essence of a house. It's a window. There's a theory in psychology called the broken windows theory, that when you break windows, you didn't really do anything. But it shows that we don't care about this area. It shows that we don't care about who lives in the house. It shows that we don't take seriously that there's not much worth here. And so people were killed. Sifrei Torah were destroyed. Businesses were destroyed. People were arrested. But perhaps the most significant element of it was that it put up a big sign to the entire German country saying that the Jews are no longer protected. Their essence is considered to be marked and targeted. We don't care about the legal stuff. We don't care that we actually killed people or destroyed. We broke the windows. That's what we call this night because of what it signified. That Jewish people were no longer protected. Jewish people had a target. And so in that memory, in their memory, we should try to focus on the positive of what it means in essence to be Jewish and to share that with others. So that's the end of the halachic part of the shiur and what I think we can take away from it. So if we end the shiur right now, and we're not because there's another page and a half, but if we would end the shiur right now, we would have a very nice idea, a halachic definition of what the avos were. Last week, we spoke about the avos relationship to mitzvahs, that they were very connected to God. They were able to make this spiritual calculus to figure out what they needed to do, what they didn't need to do, what they should do, what they shouldn't do. And this week we focused on halachically, what is their status? We said from Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, we said from Rav Chaim, we said from Rav Asher Weiss that in essence they were Jewish, but legally they weren't. So what that means is that what the Avos bequeathed to us for all generations is what it means to be in essence Jewish. The mahus, the cheftza of being Jewish we got from the Avos. What that means, what it means to be in essence a Jew, we'll talk about in later weeks. But while this is a very nice story, there are actually two questions, not what we colloquially say in yeshiva as bam kashas, questions that threaten the entire integrity of the idea, but there are two oddities about the story that happened to Rav Asher Lemel that historians have struggled with. This was ostensibly a guy that came from Morocco to the Ashkenazi community to convert. Two questions. First of all, why didn't he just convert in Morocco? Right? There was a robust Jewish community there for hundreds of years. They had a bat mitzvah and they could do conversions there. Right, so why did he go to Israel? Okay, so maybe you'd say, he wanted to make this religious pilgrimage. Okay. The second thing is that if he grew up in Morocco, why did he go to the Ashkenazi community? It's a little weird, right? This was presumably an Arab. He would have culturally much more in common with the Sephardi community. And also, he probably knew about it more. So why did he gravitate towards the Ashkenazi community? And again, none of these things, say, okay, we have to throw out this entire thing. It's fabricated. But it's clear that there's something going on behind the scenes that we just didn't know. And about 10 years ago, someone filled in the blanks. This is an article in source number 13 from the Sfarim blog, which is a blog. And it was posted by a Rabbi Malevsky, who is now currently a Rav in Canada. He used to. I'm sorry? Oh, he was your rabbi. Wow. Okay. I'm sorry? Oh, okay. So he's currently a Rav in Toronto. Before that, he was a Rav in America. Oh, now he's moved to Baltimore. Okay. So he did some digging. Apparently, a while back, on Har HaZeisim, they found a grave of a person named Werder Crescent. And that was not his name on the grave, but historians did research, they found journals, and they eventually figured out that there was this person named Werder Crescent, who was actually a very well-known figure. He was an American Quaker. He grew up in Philadelphia, and he, like many Quakers, was a spiritual person. He wrote an article called Babylon, which condemned the hedonism of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and said people were too gashmiistic oriented, they were too ostentatious, they were too into Olam Hazeh. And he became acquainted with the local Jewish rabbi, the Spanish-Portuguese Mikveh Israel congregation. He became close to the rabbi there. And he became close to another Jew, Mordecai Manuel Noah from New York, who tried to found this Jewish community in upstate New York called Ararat, which would be based on Jewish ideals. It's a very interesting story. Maybe we can talk about it for another time. But he became obsessed with the Jews. He was still very much a Christian. And so he wanted to convert Jews to Christianity. So he applied to the U.S. government to be the first U.S. consul to the Ottoman Empire in Jerusalem. And so he wanted to be an American diplomat. He was the first U.S. consul in Yerushalayim. Werner Cresson comes to Yerushalayim, if you turn the page. He comes to, in the second paragraph, he comes to Yerushalayim in 1844. And he joins a bunch of missionaries to try to convert Jews to Judaism. And then he gets disillusioned from that. And he writes, he says, they're embezzling all the money. All the missionaries are living these wealthy lifestyles and nobody's actually getting converted. The Jews are just remaining Jews. And he gets dissatisfied with the whole enterprise. And he learns more about Judaism. And eventually he decides to convert. And he says, look, this seems to be it. And so in 1847, he writes another book called The Key of David, The True Messiah. And he denies the divinity of Jesus. And he decides that he's ready to become a Jew. And if you look, this is the third paragraph on the page. And he says, he writes, I remained in Jerusalem in my former faith until the 28th day of March, 1848. When I became fully satisfied that I could never obtain strength and rest, Shabbos. But by doing as Ruth did, as Rus, and saying to her mother-in-law, Naomi, entreat me not to leave thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. In short, upon the 28th day of March, 1848, same year, I was circumcised, entered the Holy Covenant, and became a Jew. So Werner Cresson became Michal Boaz Yisrael. That was the name he took on. Again, the allusion to Naomi of Boaz. Ben Avraham. And he returned to the United States for a few years. His family tried to declare him clinically insane to take away his assets. They were freaked out that he became a Jew. He tried to convert his family and they weren't interested. They tried to declare him clinically insane. He proved himself to be of sound mind. And so he just eventually just divorced his family and left. And he joined the Jewish community in Yerushalayim. And he married a Sephardic woman named Rachel Maladano. And he died in 1865 and was buried on Har HaZeisim. And they found his grave. And there's a lot of interesting nuances about his story. But the 28th day of March happens to be Chaf Gimel. I'm sorry, it was a typo in the first one. It was Chaf Gimel Adar Sheni, which was the day that he converted. If you look back, it was exactly it. Chaf Gimel. The same as the Moroccan. And so this Rabbi Malevsky said, spelling Morocco in Hebrew, if you just flip around the letter or two, Morocco becomes America. And so somebody either made a mistake or couldn't fathom that somebody from America would come to Israel to convert at that point. And so America just became Morocco in one of the iterations of the letter. And so this person, the reason why he came to the Ashkenazi community is, yes, even though the Spanish Portuguese are technically Sephardim, culturally, he was much more in sync with the Ashkenazi community. So he just gravitated towards the Ashkenazi community. That was probably who they tried to recruit when they tried to missionize, right? They didn't missionize the Sephardim as much because different culture, different language, different religion that they were competing against. So he was probably very connected to the Ashkenazi community at that point when he decided to join. And so now we know exactly who this person was. And for all we know, we don't know have so much of his life post-conversion, but from his records, he seems to have been a very sincere convert. He did it completely l'shem shamayim. He turned his back on his entire life. He literally cried for having to violate Shabbos when he was told that he wasn't Jewish yet. He was so frum, he didn't want a non-Jewish person to violate Shabbos for him. That was his essence became Jewish. And so when we talk about that, when a person is circumcised and the legacy that we got from the Avos of being Heftza Yisrael, being an essence of a Jew, when he converted, he embodied that. He embodied the Heftza of Yisrael, being an essence a Jew. So once again, that's the end of what I want to speak about with you tonight. Next week, what I hope to talk about is to continue on the theme of Bris Milah, And we'll talk about a little bit more about the transformation that occurred when they became circumcised and how, why we went through another circumcision and another almost conversion process, as it were, before we got the Torah. Because the same thing that happened when Avraham entered into a covenant with God happened on a much larger scale at Matan Torah. And so we'll talk about that evolution from the perspective of both Rav Aaron Lichtenstein as well as the Lubavitcher Rebbe. They say the same thing in very different words. But I'll show you how it can both be traced back to a Ramban. That's what we'll talk about next week. But once again, I want to reiterate that the learning this week was done in memory of those that were killed in the tragedy of Kristallnacht, as well as the terrible Chil Hashem that took place, and in memory of everything that happened afterwards, of all the lives that were tragically lost. And as Rav Yaakov Ettlinger said, that there is something known as being an essence of a Jew that's connected to circumcision, that's connected to Shabbos, and we should tap into that, whether it means having a different Shabbos experience this week, maybe sharing the beauty of Shabbos with others, maybe inviting someone over for a meal, maybe wishing good Shabbos or calling somebody beforehand. That's what it means to be the essence of a Jew, to follow in the footsteps of Avram, to do chesed. And may everybody's memory be remembered for good. And hopefully next year, when we commemorate this, we will do it under much happier circumstances in Yerushalayim. Have a good night, everyone.
Very happy to see that all the lights in the store are turned on. Thank you.